Chapter 1. He was an inch, perhaps two, under 6 feet, powerfully built, and he advanced straight at you with a slight stoop of the shoulders, head forward, and a fixed from under stare which made you think of a charging bull. His voice was deep, loud, and his manner displayed a kind of dogged self-assertion which had nothing aggressive in it. It seemed a necessity, and it was directed apparently as much at himself as at anybody else. He was spotlessly neat, apparelled in immaculate white from shoes to hat, and in the various eastern ports where he got his living as ship chandler's water clerk he was very popular. A water clerk need not pass an examination in anything under the sun, but he must have ability in the abstract and demonstrate it practically. His work consists in racing under sail, steam, or oars against other water clerks for any ship about to anchor, greeting her captain cheerily, forcing upon him a card, the business card of the ship chandler, and on his first visit on shore piloting him firmly but without ostentation to a vast, cavern-like shop which is full of things that are eaten and drunk on board ship, where you can get everything to make her seaworthy and beautiful, from a set of chain hooks for her cable to a book of gold leaf for the carvings of her stern, and where her commander is received like a brother by a ship chandler he has never seen before. There is a cool parlor, easy chairs, bottles, cigars, writing implements, a copy of harbor regulations, and a warmth of welcome that melts the salt of a 3 months' passage out of a seaman's heart. The connection thus begun is kept up, as long as the ship remains in harbor, by the daily visits of the water clerk. To the captain he is faithful like a friend and attentive like a son, with the patience of Job, the unselfish devotion of a woman, and the jollity of a boon companion. Later on the bill is sent in. It is a beautiful and humane occupation. Therefore good water clerks are scarce. When a water clerk who possesses ability in the abstract has also the advantage of having been brought up to the sea, he is worth to his employer a lot of money and some humoring. Jim had always good wages and as much humoring as would have bought the fidelity of a fiend. Nevertheless, with black ingratitude he would throw up the job suddenly and depart. To his employers the reasons he gave were obviously inadequate. They said, "Confounded fool!" as soon as his back was turned. This was their criticism on his exquisite sensibility. To the white men in the waterside business and to the captains of ships he was just Jim, nothing more. He had, of course, another name, but he was anxious that it should not be pronounced. His incognito, which had as many holes as a sieve, was not meant to hide a personality but a fact. When the fact broke through the incognito he would leave suddenly the seaport where he happened to be at the time and go to another generally farther east. He kept to seaports because he was a seaman in exile from the sea, and had ability in the abstract, which is good for no other work but that of a water clerk. He retreated in good order towards the rising sun, and the fact followed him casually but inevitably. Thus in the course of years he was known successively in Bombay, in Calcutta, in Rangoon, in Penang, in Batavia, and in each of these halting places was just Jim the water clerk. Afterwards, when his keen perception of the intolerable drove him away for good from seaports and white men, even into the virgin forest, the Malays of the jungle village, where he had elected to conceal his deplorable faculty, added a word to the monosyllable of his incognito. They called him Tone Jim, as one might say Lord Jim. Originally he came from a parsonage. Many commanders of fine merchant ships come from these abodes of piety and peace. Jim's father possessed such certain knowledge of the unknowable as made for the righteousness of people in cottages without disturbing the ease of mind of those whom an unerring providence enables to live in mansions. The little church on a hill had the mossy greyness of a rock seen through a ragged screen of leaves. It had stood there for centuries, but the trees around probably remembered the laying of the first stone. Below, the red front of the rectory gleamed with a warm tint in the midst of grass plots, flower beds, and fir trees, with an orchard at the back, a paved stable yard to the left, and the sloping glass of greenhouses tacked along a wall of bricks. The living had belonged to the family for generations, but Jim was one of five sons, and when after a course of light holiday literature his vocation for the sea had declared itself, he was sent at once to a training ship for officers of the mercantile marine. He learned there a little trigonometry and how to cross top-gallant yards. He was generally liked. He had the third place in navigation and pulled stroke in the first cutter. Having a steady head with an excellent physique, he was very smart aloft. His station was in the foretop, and often from there he looked down, with the contempt of a man destined to shine in the midst of dangers, at the peaceful multitude of roofs cut in two by the brown tide of the stream, while scattered on the outskirts of the surrounding plain the factory chimneys rose perpendicular against a grimy sky, each slender like a pencil, and belching out smoke like a volcano. He could see the big ships departing, the broad-beamed ferries constantly on the move, the little boats floating far below his feet, with the hazy splendor of the sea in the distance, and the hope of a stirring life in the world of adventure. On the lower deck in the babel of 200 voices he would forget himself, and beforehand live in his mind the sea life of light literature. He saw himself saving people from sinking ships, cutting away masts in a hurricane, swimming through a surf with a line, or as a lonely castaway, barefooted and half-naked, walking on uncovered reefs in search of shellfish to stave off starvation. He confronted savages on tropical shores, quelled mutinies on the high seas, and in a small boat upon the ocean kept up the hearts of despairing men always an example of devotion to duty, and as unflinching as a hero in a book. "Something's up. Come along." He leapt to his feet. The boys were streaming up the ladders. Above could be heard a great scurrying about and shouting, and when he got through the hatchway he stood still as if confounded. It was the dusk of a winter's day. The gale had freshened since noon, stopping the traffic on the river, and now blew with the strength of a hurricane in fitful bursts that boom like salvos of great guns firing over the ocean. The rain slanted in sheets that flicked and subsided, and between whiles Jim had threatening glimpses of the tumbling tide, the small craft jumbled and tossing along the shore, the motionless buildings in the driving mist, the broad ferry boats pitching ponderously at anchor, the vast landing stages heaving up and down and smothered in sprays. The next gust seemed to blow all this away. The air was full of flying water. There was a fierce purpose in the gale, a furious earnestness in the screech of the wind, in the brutal tumult of earth and sky, that seemed directed at him, and made him hold his breath in awe. He stood still. It seemed to him he was whirled around. He was jostled. Man the cutter. Boys rushed past him. A coaster running in for shelter had crashed through a schooner at anchor, and one of the ship's instructors had seen the accident. A mob of boys clambered on the rails, clustered round the davits. Collision. Just ahead of us. Mr. Simon saw it. A push made him stagger against the mizzenmast, and he caught hold of a rope. The old training ship chained to her moorings quivered all over, bowing gently head to wind, and with her scanty rigging humming in a deep bass the breathless song of her youth at sea. Lower away. He saw the boat, manned, drop swiftly below the rail, and rushed after her. He heard a splash. Let go, clear the falls. He leaned over. The river alongside seethed in frothy streaks. The cutter could be seen in the falling darkness under the spell of tide and wind, that for a moment held her bound, and tossing abreast of the ship. A yelling voice in her reached him faintly, "Keep stroke, you young whelps, if you want to save anybody. Keep stroke." And suddenly she lifted high her bow, and, leaping with raised oars over a wave, broke the spell cast upon her by the wind and tide. Jim felt his shoulder gripped firmly. "Too late, youngster." The captain of the ship laid a restraining hand on that boy, who seemed on the point of leaping overboard, and Jim looked up with the pain of conscious defeat in his eyes. The captain smiled sympathetically. "Better luck next time. This will teach you to be smart." A shrill cheer greeted the cutter. She came dancing back half full of water, and with two exhausted men washing about on her bottom boards. The tumult and the menace of wind and sea now appeared very contemptible to Jim, increasing the regret of his awe at their inefficient menace. Now he knew what to think of it. It seemed to him he cared nothing for the gale. He could affront greater perils. He would do so better than anybody. Not a particle of fear was left. Nevertheless, he brooded apart that evening while the bowman of the cutter, a boy with a face like a girl's and big gray eyes, was the hero of the lower deck. Eager questioners crowded round him. He narrated, "I just saw his head bobbing, and I dashed my boat hook in the water. It caught in his breeches and I nearly went overboard, as I thought I would. Only old Simons let go the tiller and grabbed my legs, the boat nearly swamped. Old Simons is a fine old chap. I don't mind a bit him being grumpy with us. He swore at me all the time he held my leg, but that was only his way of telling me to stick to the boat hook. Old Simons is awfully excitable, isn't he? No, not the little fair chap, the other, the big one with a beard. When we pulled him in he groaned, 'Oh, my leg. Oh, my leg.' And turned up his eyes. Fancy such a big chap fainting like a girl. Would any of you fellows faint for a jab with a boat hook? I wouldn't. It went into his leg so far." He showed the boat hook, which he had carried below for the purpose, and produced a sensation. "No, silly. It was not his flesh that held him as breeches did. Lots of blood, of course." Jim thought it a pitiful display of vanity. The gale had ministered to a heroism as spurious as its own pretense of terror. He felt angry with the brutal tumult of earth and sky for taking him unawares and checking unfairly a generous readiness for narrow escapes. Otherwise he was rather glad he had not gone into the cutter, since a lower achievement had served the turn. He had enlarged his knowledge more than those who had done the work. When all men flinched, then he felt sure he alone would know how to deal with the spurious menace of wind and seas. He knew what to think of it. Seen dispassionately, it seemed contemptible. He could detect no trace of emotion in himself, and the final effect of a staggering event was that, unnoticed and apart from the noisy crowd of boys, he exulted with fresh certitude in his avidity for adventure, and in a sense of many-sided courage. Chapter 2. After 2 years of training he went to sea, and entering the regions so well known to his imagination, found them strangely barren of adventure. He made many voyages. He knew the magic monotony of existence between sky and water. He had to bear the criticism of men, the exactions of the sea, and the prosaic severity of the daily task that gives bread but whose only reward is in the perfect love of the work. This reward eluded him. Yet he could not go back, because there is nothing more enticing, disenchanting, and enslaving than the life at sea. Besides, his prospects were good. He was gentlemanly, steady, tractable, with a thorough knowledge of his duties, and in time, when yet very young, he became chief mate of a fine ship, without ever having been tested by those events of the sea that show in the light of day the inner worth of a man, the edge of his temper, and the fiber of his stuff, that reveal the quality of his resistance and the secret truth of his pretenses, not only to others but also to himself. Only once in all that time he had again a glimpse of the earnestness and the anger of the sea. That truth is not so often made apparent as people might think. There are many shades in the danger of adventures and gales, and it is only now and then that there appears on the face of facts a sinister violence of intention, that indefinable something which forces it upon the mind and the heart of a man, that this complication of accidents or these elemental furies are coming at him with a purpose of malice, with a strength beyond control, with an unbridled cruelty that means to tear out of him his hope and his fear, the pain of his fatigue and his longing for rest, which means to smash, to destroy, to annihilate all he has seen, known, loved, enjoyed, or hated, all that is priceless and necessary, the sunshine, the memories, the future, which means to sweep the whole precious world utterly away from his sight by the simple and appalling act of taking his life. Jim, disabled by a falling spar at the beginning of a week of which his Scottish captain used to say afterwards, "Man, it's a perfect miracle to me how she lived through it." Spent many days stretched on his back, dazed, battered, hopeless, and tormented as if at the bottom of an abyss of unrest. He did not care what the end would be, and in his lucid moments overvalued his indifference. The danger, when not seen, has the imperfect vagueness of human thought. The fear grows shadowy, and imagination, the enemy of men, the father of all terrors, unstimulated, sinks to rest in the dullness of exhausted emotion. Jim saw nothing but the disorder of his tossed cabin. He lay there battened down in the midst of a small devastation, and felt secretly glad he had not to go on deck. But now and again an uncontrollable rush of anguish would grip him bodily, make him gasp and writhe under the blankets, and then the unintelligent brutality of an existence liable to the agony of such sensations filled him with a despairing desire to escape at any cost. Then fine weather returned, and he thought no more about it. His lameness, however, persisted, and when the ship arrived at an eastern port he had to go to the hospital. His recovery was slow, and he was left behind. There were only two other patients in the white men's ward, the purser of a gunboat, who had broken his leg falling down a hatchway, and a kind of railway contractor from a neighboring province, afflicted by some mysterious tropical disease, who held the doctor for an ass, and indulged in secret debaucheries of patent medicine which his Tamil servant used to smuggle in with unwearied devotion. They told each other the story of their lives, played cards a little, or, yawning and in pajamas, lounged through the day in easy chairs without saying a word. The hospital stood on a hill, and a gentle breeze entering through the windows, always flung wide open, brought into the bare room the softness of the sky, the languor of the earth, the bewitching breath of the eastern waters. There were perfumes in it, suggestions of infinite repose, the gift of endless dreams. Jim looked every day over the thickets of gardens, beyond the roofs of the town, over the fronds of palms growing on the shore, at that roadstead which is a thoroughfare to the east, at the roadstead dotted by garlanded islets, lighted by festal sunshine, its ships like toys, its brilliant activity resembling a holiday pageant, with the eternal serenity of the eastern sky overhead and the smiling peace of the eastern seas possessing the space as far as the horizon. Directly he could walk without a stick, he descended into the town to look for some opportunity to get home. Nothing offered just then, and, while waiting, he associated naturally with the men of his calling in the port. These were of two kinds. Some, very few and seen there but seldom, led mysterious lives, had preserved an undefaced energy with the temper of buccaneers and the eyes of dreamers. They appeared to live in a crazy maze of plans, hopes, dangers, enterprises, ahead of civilization, in the dark places of the sea, and their death was the only event of their fantastic existence that seemed to have a reasonable certitude of achievement. The majority were men who, like himself, thrown there by some accident, had remained as officers of country ships. They had now a horror of the home service, with its harder conditions, severer view of duty, and the hazard of stormy oceans. They were attuned to the eternal peace of eastern sky and sea. They loved short passages, good deck chairs, large native crews, and the distinction of being white. They shuddered at the thought of hard work, and led precariously easy lives, always on the verge of dismissal, always on the verge of engagement, serving Chinamen, Arabs, half-castes would have served the devil himself had he made it easy enough. They talked everlastingly of turns of luck, how so-and-so got charge of a boat on the coast of China, a soft thing, how this one had an easy billet in Japan somewhere, and that one was doing well in the Siamese Navy, and in all they said in their actions, in their looks, in their persons could be detected the soft spot, the place of decay, the determination to lounge safely through existence. To Jim that gossiping crowd, viewed as seamen, seemed at first more unsubstantial than so many shadows. But at length he found a fascination in the sight of those men, in their appearance of doing so well on such a small allowance of danger and toil. In time, beside the original disdain there grew up slowly another sentiment, and suddenly, giving up the idea of going home, he took a berth as chief mate of the Patna. The Patna was a local steamer as old as the hills, lean like a greyhound, and eaten up with rust worse than a condemned water tank. She was owned by a Chinaman, chartered by an Arab, and commanded by a sort of renegade New South Wales German, very anxious to curse publicly his native country, but who, apparently on the strength of Bismarck's victorious policy, brutalized all those he was not afraid of, and wore a blood and iron air, combined with a purple nose and a red mustache. After she had been painted outside and whitewashed inside, 800 pilgrims, more or less, were driven on board of her as she lay with steam up alongside a wooden jetty. They streamed aboard over three gangways, they streamed in urged by faith and the hope of paradise, they streamed in with a continuous tramp and shuffle of bare feet, without a word, a murmur, or a look back, and when clear of confining rails spread on all sides over the deck, flowed forward and aft, overflowed down the yawning hatchways, filled the inner recesses of the ship like water filling a cistern, like water flowing into crevices and crannies, like water rising silently even with the rim. 800 men and women with faith and hopes, with affections and memories, they had collected there, coming from north and south and from the outskirts of the east, after treading the jungle paths, descending the rivers, coasting in prows along the shallows, crossing in small canoes from island to island, passing through suffering, meeting strange sights, beset by strange fears, upheld by one desire. They came from solitary huts in the wilderness, from populous kampongs, from villages by the sea. At the call of an idea they had left their forests, their clearings, the protection of their rulers, their prosperity, their poverty, the surroundings of their youth and the graves of their fathers. They came covered with dust, with sweat, with grime, with rags, the strong men at the head of family parties, the lean old men pressing forward without hope of return, young boys with fearless eyes glancing curiously, shy little girls with tumbled long hair, the timid women muffled up and clasping to their breasts, wrapped in loose ends of soiled headcloths, their sleeping babies, the unconscious pilgrims of an exacting belief. "Look at Desi cattle," said the German skipper to his new chief mate. An Arab, the leader of that pious voyage, came last. He walked slowly aboard, handsome and grave in his white gown and large turban. A string of servants followed, loaded with his luggage. The Patna cast off and backed away from the wharf. She was headed between two small islets, crossed obliquely the anchoring ground of sailing ships, swung through half a circle in the shadow of a hill, then ranged close to a ledge of foaming reefs. The Arab, standing up aft, recited aloud the prayer of travelers by sea. He invoked the favor of the Most High upon the journey, implored his blessing on men's toil and on the secret purposes of their hearts. The steamer pounded in the dusk the calm water of the strait, and far astern of the pilgrim ship a screw-pile lighthouse, planted by unbelievers on a treacherous shoal, seemed to wink at her its eye of flame, as if in derision of her errand of faith. She cleared the strait, crossed the bay, continued on her way through the 1-degree passage. She held on straight for the Red Sea under a serene sky, under a sky scorching and unclouded, enveloped in a full gore of sunshine that killed all thought, oppressed the heart, withered all impulses of strength and energy. And under the sinister splendor of that sky the sea, blue and profound, remained still, without a stir, without a ripple, without a wrinkle, viscous, stagnant, dead. The Patna, with a slight hiss, passed over that plain, luminous and smooth, unrolled a black ribbon of smoke across the sky, left behind her on the water a white ribbon of foam that vanished at once, like the phantom of a track drawn upon a lifeless sea by the phantom of a steamer. Every morning the sun, as if keeping pace in his revolutions with the progress of the pilgrimage, emerged with a silent burst of light exactly at the same distance astern of the ship, caught up with her at noon, pouring the concentrated fire of his rays on the pious purposes of the men, glided past on his descent, and sank mysteriously into the sea evening after evening, preserving the same distance ahead of her advancing bows. The five whites on board lived amidships, isolated from the human cargo. The awnings covered the deck with a white roof from stem to stern, and a faint hum, a low murmur of sad voices, alone revealed the presence of a crowd of people upon the great blaze of the ocean. Such were the days, still, hot, heavy, disappearing one by one into the past, as if falling into an abyss forever open in the wake of the ship, and the ship, lonely under a wisp of smoke, held on her steadfast way black and smoldering in a luminous immensity, as if scorched by a flame flicked at her from a heaven without pity. The nights descended on her like a benediction. Chapter 3. A marvelous stillness pervaded the world, and the stars, together with the serenity of their rays, seemed to shed upon the earth the assurance of everlasting security. The young moon recurved, and shining low in the west, was like a slender shaving thrown up from a bar of gold, and the Arabian Sea, smooth and cool to the eye like a sheet of ice, extended its perfect level to the perfect circle of a dark horizon. The propeller turned without a check, as though its speed had been part of the scheme of a safe universe, and on each side of the pod two deep folds of water, permanent and somber on the unwrinkled shimmer, enclosed within their straight and diverging ridges a few white swirls of foam bursting in a low hiss, a few wavelets, a few ripples, a few undulations that, left behind, agitated the surface of the sea for an instant after the passage of the ship, subsided splashing gently, calmed down at last into the circular stillness of water and sky with the black speck of the moving hull remaining everlastingly in its center. Jim on the bridge was penetrated by the great certitude of unbounded safety and peace that could be read on the silent aspect of nature like the certitude of fostering love upon the placid tenderness of a mother's face. Below the roof of awnings, surrendered to the wisdom of white men and to their courage, trusting the power of their unbelief and the iron shell of their fireship, the pilgrims of an exacting faith slept on mats, on blankets, on bare planks, on every deck, in all the dark corners, wrapped in dyed cloths, muffled in soiled rags, with their heads resting on small bundles, with their faces pressed to bent forearms, the men, the women, the children, the old with the young, the decrepit with the lusty all equal before sleep, death's brother. A draft of air, fanned from forward by the speed of the ship, passed steadily through the long gloom between the high bulwarks, swept over the rows of prone bodies, a few dim flames and globe lamps were hung short here and there under the ridge poles, and in the blurred circles of light thrown down and trembling slightly to the unceasing vibration of the ship appeared a chin upturned, two closed eyelids, a dark hand with silver rings, a meager limb draped in a torn covering, a head bent back, a naked foot, a throat bared and stretched as if offering itself to the knife. The well-to-do had made for their families shelters with heavy boxes and dusty mats, the poor reposed side by side with all they had on earth tied up in a rag under their heads, the lone old men slept, with drawn-up legs, upon their prayer carpets, with their hands over their ears and one elbow on each side of the face, a father, his shoulders up and his knees under his forehead, dozed dejectedly by a boy who slept on his back with tousled hair and one arm commandingly extended, a woman covered from head to foot, like a corpse, with a piece of white sheeting, had a naked child in the hollow of each arm, the Arab's belongings, piled right aft, made a heavy mound of broken outlines, with a cargo lamp swung above, and a great confusion of vague forms behind, gleams of paunchy brass pots, the footrest of a deck chair, blades of spears, the straight scabbard of an old sword leaning against a heap of pillows, the spout of a tin coffee pot. The patent log on the taffrail periodically rang a single tinkling stroke for every mile traversed on an errand of faith. Above the mass of sleepers a faint and patient sigh at times floated, the exhalation of a troubled dream, and short metallic clangs bursting out suddenly in the depths of the ship, the harsh scrape of a shovel, the violent slam of a furnace door, exploded brutally, as if the men handling the mysterious things below had their breasts full of fierce anger, while the slim high hull of the steamer went on evenly ahead, without a sway of her bare masts, cleaving continuously the great calm of the waters under the inaccessible serenity of the sky. Jim paced athwart, and his footsteps in the vast silence were loud to his own ears, as if echoed by the watchful stars, his eyes, roaming about the line of the horizon, seemed to gaze hungrily into the unattainable, and did not see the shadow of the coming event. The only shadow on the sea was the shadow of the black smoke pouring heavily from the funnel its immense streamer, whose end was constantly dissolving in the air. Two Malays, silent and almost motionless, steered, one on each side of the wheel, whose brass rim shone fragmentarily in the oval of light thrown out by the binnacle. now and then a hand, with black fingers alternately letting go and catching hold of revolving spokes, appeared in the aluminum part, the links of wheel chains ground heavily in the grooves of the barrel. Jim would glance at the compass, would glance around the unattainable horizon, would stretch himself till his joints cracked, with a leisurely twist of the body, in the very excess of well-being, and, as if made audacious by the invincible aspect of the piece, he felt he cared for nothing that could happen to him to the end of his days. From time to time he glanced idly at a chart pegged out with four drawing pins on a low three-legged table abaft the steering gear case. The sheet of paper portraying the depths of the sea presented a shiny surface under the light of a bull's-eye lamp lashed to a stanchion, a surface as level and smooth as the glimmering surface of the waters. Parallel rulers with a pair of dividers reposed on it, the ship's position at last noon was marked with a small black cross, and the straight pencil line drawn firmly as far as Perim figured the course of the ship, the path of souls towards the holy place, the promise of salvation, the reward of eternal life, while the pencil with its sharp end touching the Somali coast lay round and still like a naked ship's spar floating in the pool of a sheltered dock. How steady she goes, thought Jim with wonder, with something like gratitude for this high piece of sea and sky. At such times his thoughts would be full of valorous deeds. He loved these dreams and the success of his imaginary achievements. They were the best parts of life, its secret truth, its hidden reality. They had a gorgeous virility, the charm of vagueness. They passed before him with an heroic tread, they carried his soul away with them and made it drunk with the divine filter of an unbounded confidence in itself. There was nothing he could not face. He was so pleased with the idea that he smiled, keeping perfunctorily his eyes ahead, and when he happened to glance back he saw the white streak of the wake drawn as straight by the ship's keel upon the sea as the black line drawn by the pencil upon the chart. The ash buckets racketed, clanking up and down the stokehold ventilators, and this tin pot clatter warned him the end of his watch was near. He sighed with content, with regret as well at having to part from that serenity which fostered the adventurous freedom of his thoughts. He was a little sleepy too, and felt a pleasurable languor running through every limb as though all the blood in his body had turned to warm milk. His skipper had come up noiselessly, in pajamas and with his sleeping jacket flung wide open. Red of face, only half awake, the left eye partly closed, the right staring stupid and glassy, he hung his big head over the chart and scratched his rib sleepily. There was something obscene in the sight of his naked flesh. His bared breast glistened soft and greasy as though he had sweated out his fat in his sleep. He pronounced a professional remark in a voice harsh and dead, resembling the rasping sound of a wood file on the edge of a plank. The fold of his double chin hung like a bag triced up close under the hinge of his jaw. Jim started, and his answer was full of deference, but the odious and fleshy figure, as though seen for the first time in a revealing moment, fixed itself in his memory forever as the incarnation of everything vile and base that lurks in the world we love, in our own hearts we trust for our salvation, in the men that surround us, in the sights that fill our eyes, in the sounds that fill our ears, and in the air that fills our lungs. The thin gold shaving of the moon floating slowly downwards had lost itself on the darkened surface of the waters, and the eternity beyond the sky seemed to come down nearer to the earth, with the augmented glitter of the stars, with the more profound somberness in the luster of the half-transparent dome covering the flat disk of an opaque sea. The ship moved so smoothly that her onward motion was imperceptible to the senses of men, as though she had been a crowded planet speeding through the dark spaces of ether behind the swarm of suns, in the appalling and calm solitudes awaiting the breath of future creations. "Hot is no name for it down below," said a voice. Jim smiled without looking round. The skipper presented an unmoved breadth of back. It was the renegade's trick to appear pointedly unaware of your existence unless it suited his purpose to turn at you with a devouring glare before he let loose a torrent of foamy, abusive jargon that came like a gush from a sewer. Now he emitted only a sulky grunt, the second engineer at the head of the bridge ladder, kneading with damp palms a dirty sweat rag, unabashed, continued the tale of his complaints. The sailors had a good time of it up here, and what was the use of them in the world? He would be blowed if he could see. The poor devils of engineers had to get the ship along anyhow, and they could very well do the rest too. By gosh, they shut up, growled the German stolidly. "Oh yes. Shut up, and when anything goes wrong you fly to us, don't you?" went on the other. He was more than half cooked, he expected, but anyway, now, he did not mind how much he sinned, because these last 3 days he had passed through a fine course of training for the place where the bad boys go when they die. By gosh, he had besides being made jolly well deaf by the blasted racket below. That earned, compound, surface condensing, rotten scrap he prattled and banged down there like an old deck winch, only more so, and what made him risk his life every night and day that God made amongst the refuse of a breaking up yard flying round at 57 revolutions, was more than he could tell. He must have been born reckless, By gosh! He! Where did you get drink? Inquired the German, very savage, but motionless in the light of the binnacle, like a clumsy effigy of a man cut out of a block of fat. Jim went on smiling at the retreating horizon. His heart was full of generous impulses, and his thought was contemplating his own superiority. Drink! Repeated the engineer with amiable scorn. He was hanging on with both hands to the rail, a shadowy figure with flexible legs. Not from you, Captain. You're far too mean, by gosh. You would let a good man die sooner than give him a drop of schnapps. That's what you Germans call economy. Penny wise, pound foolish. He became sentimental. The chief had given him a four-finger nip about 10 o'clock. Only one, s'help me exclamation mark good old chief, but as to getting the old fraud out of his bunk, a 5-ton crane couldn't do it. Not it. Not tonight anyhow. He was sleeping sweetly like a little child, with a bottle of prime brandy under his pillow. From the thick throat of the commander of the Potna came a low rumble, on which the sound of the word Schwein fluttered high and low like a capricious feather in a faint stir of air. He and the chief engineer had been cronies for a good few years, serving the same jovial, crafty, old Chinaman, with horn-rimmed goggles and strings of red silk plaited into the venerable gray hairs of his pigtail. The quayside opinion in the Patna's home port was that these two in the way of brazen peculation had done together pretty well everything you can think of. Outwardly they were badly matched, one dull-eyed, malevolent, and of soft fleshy curves, the other lean, all hollows, with a head long and bony like the head of an old horse, with sunken cheeks, with sunken temples, with an indifferent glazed glance of sunken eyes. He had been stranded out east somewhere in Canton, in Shanghai, or perhaps in Yokohama. He probably did not care to remember himself the exact locality, nor yet the cause of his shipwreck. He had been, in mercy to his youth, kicked quietly out of his ship 20 years ago or more, and it might have been so much worse for him that the memory of the episode had in it hardly a trace of misfortune. Then, steam navigation expanding in these seas and men of his craft being scarce at first, he had got on after a sort. He was eager to let strangers know in a dismal mumble that he was an old stager out here. When he moved, a skeleton seemed to sway loose in his clothes, his walk was mere wandering, and he was given to wander thus around the engine room skylight, smoking, without relish, doctored tobacco in a brass bowl at the end of a cherrywood stem 4 feet long, with the imbecile gravity of a thinker evolving a system of philosophy from the hazy glimpse of a truth. He was usually anything but free with his private store of liquor, but on that night he had departed from his principles, so that his second, a weak-headed child of Wapping, what with the unexpectedness of the treat and the strength of the stuff, had become very happy, cheeky, and talkative. The fury of a New South Wales German was extreme. He puffed like an exhaust pipe, and Jim, faintly amused by the scene, was impatient for the time when he could get below. The last 10 minutes of the watch were irritating like a gun that hangs fire. Those men did not belong to the world of heroic adventure. They weren't bad chaps though. Even the skipper himself. His gorge rose at the mass of panting flesh from which issued gurgling mutters, a cloudy trickle of filthy expressions, but he was too pleasurably languid to dislike actively this or any other thing. The quality of these men did not matter. He rubbed shoulders with them, but they could not touch him. He shared the air they breathed, but he was different. Would the skipper go for the engineer? The life was easy and he was too sure of himself, too sure of himself too. The line dividing his meditation from a surreptitious doze on his feet was thinner than a thread in a spider's web. The second engineer was coming by easy transitions to the consideration of his finances and of his courage. Who's drunk? I? No, no, Captain. That won't do. You ought to know by this time the chief ain't free-hearted enough to make a sparrow drunk. By gosh! I've never been the worse for liquor in my life. The stuff ain't made yet that would make me drunk. I could drink liquid fire against your whiskey peg for peg. By gosh, and keep as cool as a cucumber. If I thought I was drunk I would jump overboard, do away with myself, by gosh. I would. Straight. And I won't go off the bridge. Where do you expect me to take the air on a night like this, eh? On deck amongst that vermin down there? Likely ain't it. And I am not afraid of anything you can do. The German lifted two heavy fists to heaven and shook them a little without a word. I don't know what fear is, pursued the engineer, with the enthusiasm of sincere conviction. I am not afraid of doing all the bloomin' work in this rotten hooker, by gosh. And a jolly good thing for you that there are some of us about the world that aren't afraid of their lives, or where would you be, you and this old thing here with her plates like brown paper, s'help me. It's all very fine for you, you get a power of pieces out of her one way and another, but what about me, what do I get? A measly $150 a month and find yourself. I wish to ask you respectfully, mind who wouldn't chuck a dratted job like this? 'Tain't safe, s'help me. It ain't. Only I am one of them fearless fellows. He let go the rail and made ample gestures as if demonstrating in the air the shape and extent of his valor. His thin voice started in prolonged squeaks upon the sea. He tiptoed back and forth for the better emphasis of utterance, and suddenly pitched down head first as though he had been clubbed from behind. He said damn. As he tumbled, an instant of silence followed upon his screeching. Jim and the skipper staggered forward by common accord, and catching themselves up, stood very stiff and still gazing, amazed, at the undisturbed level of the sea. Then they looked upwards at the stars. What had happened? The wheezy thump of the engines went on. Had the earth been checked in her course? They could not understand, and suddenly the calm sea, the sky without a cloud, appeared formidably insecure in their immobility, as if poised on the brow of yawning destruction. The engineer rebounded vertically full length and collapsed again into a vague heap. This heap said, "What's that?" in the muffled accents of profound grief. A faint noise as of thunder infinitely remote, less than a sound, hardly more than a vibration, passed slowly, and the ship quivered in response, as if the thunder had growled deep down in the water. The eyes of the two Malays at the wheel glittered towards the white men, but their dark hands remained closed on the spokes. The sharp hull driving on its way seemed to rise a few inches in succession through its whole length, as though it had become pliable, and settled down again rigidly to its work of cleaving the smooth surface of the sea. Its quivering stopped, and the faint noise of thunder ceased all at once, as though the ship had steamed across a narrow belt of vibrating water and of humming air. Chapter 4. A month or so afterwards, when Jim, in answer to pointed questions, tried to tell honestly the truth of this experience, he said, speaking of the ship, "She went over whatever it was as easy as a snake crawling over a stick." The illustration was good, the questions were aiming at facts, and the official inquiry was being held in the police court of an eastern port. He stood elevated in the witness box, with burning cheeks in a cool lofty room. The big framework of punkahs moved gently to and fro high above his head, and from below many eyes were looking at him out of dark faces, out of white faces, out of red faces, out of faces attentive, spellbound, as if all these people sitting in orderly rows upon narrow benches had been enslaved by the fascination of his voice. It was very loud, it rang startling in his own ears, it was the only sound audible in the world, for the terribly distinct questions that extorted his answers seemed to shape themselves in anguish and pain within his breast, came to him poignant and silent like the terrible questioning of one's conscience. Outside the court the sun blazed, within was the wind of great punkahs that made you shiver, the shame that made you burn, the attentive eyes whose glance stabbed. The face of the presiding magistrate, clean-shaved and impassible, looked at him deadly pale between the red faces of the two nautical assessors. The light of a broad window under the ceiling fell from above on the heads and shoulders of the three men, and they were fiercely distinct in the half-light of the big courtroom where the audience seemed composed of staring shadows. They wanted facts. Facts. They demanded facts from him, as if facts could explain anything. After you had concluded you had collided with something floating awash, say a waterlogged wreck, you were ordered by your captain to go forward and ascertain if there was any damage done. Did you think it likely from the force of the blow? Asked the assessor sitting to the left. He had a thin horseshoe beard, salient cheekbones, and with both elbows on the desk clasped his rugged hands before his face, looking at Jim with thoughtful blue eyes. The other, a heavy, scornful man, thrown back in his seat, his left arm extended full length, drummed delicately with his fingertips on a blotting pad, in the middle the magistrate upright in the roomy armchair, his head inclined slightly on the shoulder, had his arms crossed on his breast and a few flowers in a glass vase by the side of his inkstand. "I did not," said Jim. "I was told to call no one and to make no noise for fear of creating a panic. I thought the precaution reasonable. I took one of the lamps that were hung under the awnings and went forward. After opening the forepeak hatch I heard splashing in there. I lowered then the lamp the whole drift of its lanyard, and saw that the forepeak was more than half full of water already. I knew then there must be a big hole below the waterline." He paused. "Yes," said the big assessor, with a dreamy smile at the blotting pad, his fingers played incessantly, touching the paper without noise. "I did not think of danger just then. I might have been a little startled, all this happened in such a quiet way and so very suddenly. I knew there was no other bulkhead in the ship but the collision bulkhead separating the forepeak from the forehold. I went back to tell the captain. I came upon the second engineer getting up at the foot of the bridge ladder. He seemed dazed, and told me he thought his left arm was broken. He had slipped on the top step when getting down while I was forward. He exclaimed, 'My God! That rotten bulkhead'll give way in a minute, and the damned thing will go down under us like a lump of lead.' He pushed me away with his right arm and ran before me up the ladder, shouting as he climbed. His left arm hung by his side. I followed up in time to see the captain rush at him and knock him down flat on his back. He did not strike him again, he stood bending over him and speaking angrily but quite low. I fancy he was asking him why the devil he didn't go and stop the engines, instead of making a row about it on deck. I heard him say, "Get up. Run. Fly." He swore also. The engineer slid down the starboard ladder and bolted round the skylight to the engine room companion, which was on the port side. He moaned as he ran. He spoke slowly, he remembered swiftly and with extreme vividness, he could have reproduced like an echo the moaning of the engineer for the better information of these men who wanted facts. After his first feeling of revolt, he had come round to the view that only a meticulous precision of statement would bring out the true horror behind the appalling face of things. The facts those men were so eager to know had been visible, tangible, open to the senses, occupying their place in space and time, requiring for their existence a 1400-ton steamer and 27 minutes by the watch. They made a whole that had features, shades of expression, a complicated aspect that could be remembered by the eye, and something else besides, something invisible, a directing spirit of perdition that dwelt within, like a malevolent soul in a detestable body. He was anxious to make this clear. This had not been a common affair, everything in it had been of the utmost importance, and fortunately he remembered everything. He wanted to go on talking for truth's sake, perhaps for his own sake also, and while his utterance was deliberate, his mind positively flew round and round the serried circle of facts that had surged up all about him to cut him off from the rest of his kind. It was like a creature that, finding itself imprisoned within an enclosure of high stakes, dashes round and round, distracted in the night, trying to find a weak spot, a crevice, a place to scale, some opening through which it may squeeze itself and escape. This awful activity of mind made him hesitate at times in his speech. The captain kept on moving here and there on the bridge, he seemed calm enough, only he stumbled several times, and once as I stood speaking to him he walked right into me as though he had been stone blind. He made no definite answer to what I had to tell. He mumbled to himself, all I heard of it were a few words that sounded like confounded steam. And infernal steam. Something about steam. I thought. He was becoming irrelevant, a question to the point cut short his speech, like a pang of pain, and he felt extremely discouraged and weary. He was coming to that, he was coming to that and now, checked brutally, he had to answer by yes or no. He answered truthfully by a curt yes, I did, and fair of face, big of frame, with young, gloomy eyes, he held his shoulders upright above the box while his soul writhed within him. He was made to answer another question so much to the point and so useless, then waited again. His mouth was tastelessly dry, as though he had been eating dust, then salt and bitter as after a drink of seawater. He wiped his damp forehead, passed his tongue over parched lips, felt a shiver run down his back. The big assessor had dropped his eyelids, and drummed on without a sound, careless and mournful, the eyes of the other above the sunburned, clasped fingers seemed to glow with kindliness, the magistrate had swayed forward, his pale face hovered near the flowers, and then dropping sideways over the arm of his chair, he rested his temple in the palm of his hand. The wind of the punk has eddied down on the heads, on the dark-faced natives wound about in voluminous draperies, on the Europeans sitting together very hot and in drill suits that seem to fit them as close as their skins, and holding their round pith hats on their knees, while gliding along the walls the court peons, buttoned tight in long white coats, flitted rapidly to and fro, running on bare toes, red-sashed, red turban on head, as noiseless as ghosts, and on the alert like so many retrievers. Jim's eyes, wandering in the intervals of his answers, rested upon a white man who sat apart from the others, with his face worn and clouded, but with quiet eyes that glanced straight, interested and clear. Jim answered another question and was tempted to cry out, "What's the good of this? What's the good?" He tapped with his foot slightly, bit his lip, and looked away over the heads. He met the eyes of the white man. The glance directed at him was not the fascinated stare of the others. It was an act of intelligent volition. Jim between two questions forgot himself so far as to find leisure for a thought. This fellow ran the thought looks at me as though he could see somebody or something past my shoulder. He had come across that man before in the street perhaps. He was positive he had never spoken to him. For days, for many days, he had spoken to no one, but had held silent, incoherent, and endless converse with himself, like a prisoner alone in his cell or like a wayfarer lost in a wilderness. At present he was answering questions that did not matter though they had a purpose, but he doubted whether he would ever again speak out as long as he lived. The sound of his own truthful statements confirmed his deliberate opinion that speech was of no use to him any longer. That man there seemed to be aware of his hopeless difficulty. Jim looked at him, then turned away resolutely, as after a final parting. And later on, Many times, in distant parts of the world, Marlow showed himself willing to remember Jim, to remember him at length, in detail and audibly. Perhaps it would be after dinner, on a veranda draped in motionless foliage and crowned with flowers, in the deep dusk speckled by fiery cigar ends. The elongated bulk of each cane chair harbored a silent listener. Now and then a small red glow would move abruptly, and expanding light up the fingers of a languid hand, part of a face in profound repose, or flash a crimson gleam into a pair of pensive eyes overshadowed by a fragment of an unruffled forehead, and with the very first word uttered Marlowe's body, extended at rest in the seat, would become very still, as though his spirit had winged its way back into the lapse of time and were speaking through his lips from the past. Chapter 5. Oh yes. I attended the inquiry, he would say, unto this day I haven't left off wondering why I went. I am willing to believe each of us has a guardian angel, if you fellas will concede to me that each of us has a familiar devil as well. I want you to own up, because I don't like to feel exceptional in any way, and I know I have him the devil, I mean. I haven't seen him, of course, but I go upon circumstantial evidence. He is there right enough, and, being malicious, he lets me in for that kind of thing. What kind of thing, you ask? Why, the inquiry thing, the yellow dog thing you wouldn't think a mangy, native tyke would be allowed to trip up people in the veranda of a magistrate's court, would you? The kind of thing that by devious, unexpected, truly diabolical ways causes me to run up against men with soft spots, with hard spots, with hidden plague spots, by Jove! And loosens their tongues at the sight of me for their infernal confidences, as though, forsooth, I had no confidences to make to myself, as though God help me. I didn't have enough confidential information about myself to harrow my own soul till the end of my appointed time. And what I have done to be thus favored I want to know. I declare I am as full of my own concerns as the next man, and I have as much memory as the average pilgrim in this valley, so you see I am not particularly fit to be a receptacle of confessions. Then why? Can't tell unless it be to make time pass away after dinner. Charlie, my dear chap, your dinner was extremely good, and in consequence these men here look upon a quiet rubber as a tumultuous occupation. They wallow in your good chairs and think to themselves, hang exertion. Let that Marlow talk. Talk? So be it. And it's easy enough to talk of Master Jim, after a good spread, 200 feet above the sea level, with a box of decent cigars handy, on a blessed evening of freshness and starlight that would make the best of us forget we are only on sufferance here and got to pick our way in cross lights, watching every precious minute and every irremediable step, trusting we shall manage yet to go out decently in the end but not so sure of it after all and with dashed little help to expect from those we touch elbows with right and left. Of course there are men here and there to whom the whole of life is like an after-dinner hour with a cigar, easy, pleasant, empty, perhaps enlivened by some fable of strife to be forgotten before the end is told even if there happens to be any end to it. My eyes met his for the first time at that inquiry. You must know that everybody connected in any way with the sea was there, because the affair had been notorious for days, ever since that mysterious cable message came from Aden to start us all cackling. I say mysterious, because it was so in a sense though it contained a naked fact, about as naked and ugly as a fact can well be. The whole waterside talked of nothing else. First thing in the morning as I was dressing in my stateroom, I would hear through the bulkhead my Percy Dubash jabbering about the Patna with the steward, while he drank a cup of tea, by favor, in the pantry. No sooner on shore I would meet some acquaintance, and the first remark would be, "Did you ever hear of anything to beat this?" And according to his kind the man would smile cynically, or look sad, or let out a swear or two. Complete strangers would accost each other familiarly, just for the sake of easing their minds on the subject. Every confounded loafer in the town came in for a harvest of drinks over this affair. You heard of it in the harbor office, at every shipbroker's, at your agent's, from whites, from natives, from half-castes, from the very boatmen squatting half-naked on the stone steps as you went up by Jove. There was some indignation, not a few jokes, and no end of discussions as to what had become of them, you know. This went on for a couple of weeks or more, and the opinion that whatever was mysterious in this affair would turn out to be tragic as well, began to prevail, when one fine morning, as I was standing in the shade by the steps of the harbor office, I perceived four men walking towards me along the quay. I wondered for a while where that queer lot had sprung from, and suddenly, I may say, I shouted to myself, "Here they are." There they were, sure enough, three of them as large as life, and one much larger of girth than any living man has a right to be, just landed with a good breakfast inside of them from an outward bound Dale Line steamer that had come in about an hour after sunrise. There could be no mistake, I spotted the jolly skipper of the Patna at the first glance, the fattest man in the whole blessed tropical belt clear round that good old earth of ours. Moreover, 9 months or so before, I had come across him in Semarang. His steamer was loading in the roads, and he was abusing the tyrannical institutions of the German Empire, and soaking himself in beer all day long and day after day in De Jong's back shop, till De Jong, who charged a guilder for every bottle without as much as the quiver of an eyelid, would beckon me aside, and, with his little leathery face all puckered up, declare confidentially, "Business is business, but this man, Captain, he make me very sick. Tfuey." I was looking at him from the shade. He was hurrying on a little in advance, and the sunlight beating on him brought out his bulk in a startling way. He made me think of a trained baby elephant walking on hind legs. He was extravagantly gorgeous too, got up in a soiled sleeping suit, bright green and deep orange vertical stripes, with a pair of ragged straw slippers on his bare feet, and somebody's cast-off pith hat, very dirty and two sizes too small for him, tied up with a manila rope yarn on the top of his big head. You understand, a man like that hasn't the ghost of a chance when it comes to borrowing clothes. Very well. On he came in hot haste, without a look right or left, passed within 3 feet of me, and in the innocence of his heart went on pelting upstairs into the harbor office to make his deposition, or report, or whatever you like to call it. It appears he addressed himself in the first instance to the principal shipping master. Archie Ruthville had just come in, and, as his story goes, was about to begin his arduous day by giving a dressing down to his chief clerk. Some of you might have known him, an obliging little Portuguese half-caste with a miserably skinny neck, and always on the hop to get something from the shipmasters in the way of eatables, a piece of salt pork, a bag of biscuits, a few potatoes, or what not. One voyage, I recollect, I tipped him a live sheep out of the remnant of my sea stock, not that I wanted him to do anything for me he couldn't, you know, but because his childlike belief in the sacred right to perquisites quite touched my heart. It was so strong as to be almost beautiful. The race, the two races rather, and the climate. However, never mind. I know where I have a friend for life. Well, Ruthful says he was giving him a severe lecture on official morality, I suppose, when he heard a kind of subdued commotion at his back, and turning his head he saw, in his own words, something round and enormous, resembling a 1600-weight sugar hogshead wrapped in striped flannelette, upended in the middle of the large floor space in the office. He declares he was so taken aback that for quite an appreciable time he did not realize the thing was alive, and sat still wondering for what purpose and by what means that object had been transported in front of his desk. The archway from the anteroom was crowded with punkapullers, sweepers, police peons, the coxswain and crew of the harbor steam launch, all craning their necks and almost climbing on each other's backs. Quite a riot. By that time the fellow had managed to tug and jerk his hat clear of his head, and advanced with slight bows at Ruthville, who told me the sight was so discomposing that for some time he listened, quite unable to make out what that apparition wanted. It spoke in a voice harsh and lugubrious but intrepid, and little by little it dawned upon Archie that this was a development of the Patna case. He says that as soon as he understood who it was before him he felt quite unwell. Archie is so sympathetic and easily upset, but pulled himself together and shouted, "Stop! I can't listen to you. You must go to the master attendant. I can't possibly listen to you. Captain Elliot is the man you want to see. This way, this way." He jumped up, ran round that long counter, pulled, shoved, the other led him, surprised but obedient at first, and only at the door of the private office some sort of animal instinct made him hang back and snort like a frightened bullock. "Look here. What's up? Let go. Look here." Archie flung open the door without knocking. "The master of the Patna, sir," he shouts. "Go in, captain." He saw the old man lift his head from some writing so sharp that his nose nippers fell off, banged the door to, and fled to his desk, where he had some papers waiting for his signature, but he says the road that burst out in there was so awful that he couldn't collect his senses sufficiently to remember the spelling of his own name. Archie's the most sensitive shipping master in the two hemispheres. He declares he felt as though he had thrown a man to a hungry lion. No doubt the noise was great. I heard it down below, and I have every reason to believe it was heard clear across the esplanade as far as the bandstand. Old Father Elliot had a great stock of words and could shout and didn't mind who he shouted at either. He would have shouted at the Viceroy himself. As he used to tell me, "I am as high as I can get, my pension is safe. I've a few pounds laid by, and if they don't like my notions of duty I would just as soon go home as not. I am an old man, and I have always spoken my mind. All I care for now is to see my girls married before I die." He was a little crazy on that point. His three daughters were awfully nice, though they resembled him amazingly, And on the mornings he woke up with a gloomy view of their matrimonial prospects, the office would read it in his eye and tremble, because, they said, he was sure to have somebody for breakfast. However, that morning he did not eat the renegade, but, if I may be allowed to carry on the metaphor, chewed him up very small, so to speak, and ejected him again. Thus in a very few moments I saw his monstrous bulk descend in haste and stand still on the outer steps. He had stopped close to me for the purpose of profound meditation, his large purple cheeks quivered. He was biting his thumb, and after a while noticed me with a sidelong vexed look. The other three chaps that had landed with him made a little group waiting at some distance. There was a sallow-faced, mean little chap with his arm in a sling, and a long individual in a blue flannel coat, as dry as a chip and no stouter than a broomstick, with drooping gray mustaches, who looked about him with an air of jaunty imbecility. The third was an upstanding, broad-shouldered youth, with his hands in his pockets, turning his back on the other two who appeared to be talking together earnestly. He stared across the empty esplanade. A ramshackle gharry, all dust and Venetian blinds, pulled up short opposite the group, and the driver, throwing up his right foot over his knee, gave himself up to the critical examination of his toes. The young chap, making no movement, not even stirring his head, just stared into the sunshine. This was my first view of Jim. He looked as unconcerned and unapproachable as only the young can look. There he stood, clean-limbed, clean-faced, firm on his feet, as promising a boy as the sun ever shone on, and, looking at him, knowing all he knew and a little more too, I was as angry as though I had detected him trying to get something out of me by false pretenses. He had no business to look so sound. I thought to myself, well, if this sort can go wrong like that. And I felt as though I could fling down my hat and dance on it from sheer mortification, as I once saw the skipper of an Italian bark do because his duffer of a mate got into a mess with his anchors when making a flying moor in a roadstead full of ships. I asked myself, seeing him there apparently so much at ease, is he silly? Is he callous? He seemed ready to start whistling a tune. And note, I did not care a rap about the behavior of the other two. Their person somehow fitted the tale that was public property, and was going to be the subject of an official inquiry. That old mad rogue upstairs called me a hound, said the captain of the Patna. I can't tell whether he recognized me, I rather think he did, but at any rate our glances met. He glared, I smiled, hound was the very mildest epithet that had reached me through the open window. Did he? I said from some strange inability to hold my tongue. He nodded, bit his thumb again, swore under his breath, then lifting his head and looking at me with sullen and passionate impudence, bah. The Pacific is big, my friend. You damned Englishman can do your worst, I know where there's plenty room for a man like me, I am well aguayan in Apia, in Honolulu, in. He paused reflectively, while without effort I could depict to myself the sort of people he was aguayan with in those places. I won't make a secret of it that I had been aguayan with not a few of that sort myself. There are times when a man must act as though life were equally sweet in any company. I've known such a time, and, what's more, I shan't now pretend to pull a long face over my necessity, because a good many of that bad company from one of moral what shall I say? Posture, or from some other equally profound cause, were twice as instructive and 20 times more amusing than the usual respectable thief of commerce you fellows ask to sit at your table without any real necessity, from habit, from cowardice, from good nature, from 100 sneaking and inadequate reasons. You Englishmen are all rogues, one on my patriotic Flensborg or Stettin Australian. I really don't recollect now what decent little port on the shores of the Baltic was defiled by being the nest of that precious bird. What are you to shout? Eh? You tell me? You know better than other people, and that old rogue he make got him fuss with me. His thick carcass trembled on its legs that were like a pair of pillars, it trembled from head to foot. That's what you English always mock a tam fuss for any little thing, because I was not born in your tam country. Take away my certificate. Take it. I don't want the certificate. A man like me don't want your verflute certificate. I spit on it. He spat. I vill an American citizen begome, he cried, fretting and fuming and shuffling his feet as if to free his ankles from some invisible and mysterious grasp that would not let him get away from that spot. He made himself so warm that the top of his bullet head positively smoked. Nothing mysterious prevented me from going away, curiosity is the most obvious of sentiments, and it held me there to see the effect of a full information upon that young fellow who, hands in pockets, and turning his back upon the sidewalk, gazed across the grass plots of the esplanade at the yellow portico of the Malabar Hotel with the air of a man about to go for a walk as soon as his friend is ready. That's how he looked, and it was odious. I waited to see him overwhelmed, confounded, pierced through and through, squirming like an impaled beetle, and I was half afraid to see it too, if you understand what I mean. Nothing more awful than to watch a man who has been found out, not in a crime but in a more than criminal weakness. The commonest sort of fortitude prevents us from becoming criminals in a legal sense. It is from weakness unknown, but perhaps suspected, as in some parts of the world you suspect a deadly snake in every bush from weakness that may lie hidden, watched or unwatched, prayed against or manfully scorned, repressed or maybe ignored more than half a lifetime. Not one of us is safe. We are snared into doing things for which we get called names, and things for which we get hanged, and yet the spirit may well survive the condemnation, survive the halter, by Jove. And there are things they look small enough sometimes too, by which some of us are totally and completely undone. I watched the youngster there. I liked his appearance, I knew his appearance, he came from the right place, he was one of us. He stood there for all the parentage of his kind, for men and women by no means clever or amusing, but his very existence is based upon honest faith, and upon the instinct of courage. I don't mean military courage, or civil courage, or any special kind of courage. I mean just that inborn ability to look temptation straight in the face, a readiness unintellectual enough, goodness knows, but without pose, a power of resistance, don't you see, ungracious if you like, but priceless and unthinking and blessed stiffness before the outward and inward terrors, before the might of nature and the seductive corruption of men backed by a faith invulnerable to the strength of facts, to the contagion of example, to the solicitation of ideas. Hang ideas. They are tramps, vagabonds, knocking at the back door of your mind, each taking a little of your substance, each carrying away some crumb of that belief in a few simple notions you must cling to if you want to live decently and would like to die easy. This has nothing to do with Jim, directly, only he was outwardly so typical of that good, stupid kind we like to feel marching right and left of us in life, of the kind that is not disturbed by the vagaries of intelligence and the perversions of nerves, let us say. He was the kind of fellow you would, on the strength of his looks, leave in charge of the deck figuratively and professionally speaking. I say I would, and I ought to know. Haven't I turned out youngsters enough in my time, for the service of the red rag, to the craft of the sea, to the craft whose whole secret could be expressed in one short sentence, and yet must be driven afresh every day into young heads till it becomes the component part of every waking thought, till it is present in every dream of their young sleep. The sea has been good to me, but when I remember all these boys that pass through my hands, some grown up now and some drowned by this time, but all good stuff for the sea, I don't think I have done badly by it either. Were I to go home tomorrow, I bet that before 2 days passed over my head some sunburned young chief mate would overtake me at some dock gateway or other, and a fresh deep voice speaking above my hat would ask, "Don't you remember me, sir? Why? Little so-and-so. Such and such a ship. It was my first voyage." And I would remember a bewildered little shaver, no higher than the back of this chair, with a mother and perhaps a big sister on the quay, very quiet but too upset to wave their handkerchiefs at the ship that glides out gently between the pier heads, or perhaps some decent middle-aged father who would come early with his boy to see him off, and stays all the morning, because he is interested in the windlass apparently, and stays too long, and has got to scramble ashore at last with no time at all to say goodbye. The mud pilot on the poop sings out to me in a drawl, "Hold her with the check line for a moment, Mr. Mate. There's a gentleman wants to get ashore." "Up with you, sir. Nearly got carried off to Talcahuano, didn't you? Now's your time, easy does it. All right. Slack away again forward there." The tugs, smoking like the pit of perdition, get hold and churn the old river into fury, the gentleman ashore is dusting his knees, the benevolent steward has shied his umbrella after him. All very proper. He has offered his bit of sacrifice to the sea, and now he may go home pretending he thinks nothing of it, and the little willing victim shall be very seasick before next morning. By and by, when he has learned all the little mysteries and the one great secret of the craft, he shall be fit to live or die as the sea may decree, and the man who had taken a hand in this fool game, in which the sea wins every toss, will be pleased to have his back slapped by a heavy young hand, and to hear a cheery sea puppy voice, "Do you remember me, sir? The little so-and-so." I tell you this is good, it tells you that once in your life at least you had gone the right way to work. I have been thus slapped, and I have winced, for the slap was heavy, and I have glowed all day long and gone to bed feeling less lonely in the world by virtue of that hearty thump. Don't I remember the little so-and-sos? I tell you I ought to know the right kind of looks. I would have trusted the deck to that youngster on the strength of a single glance, and gone to sleep with both eyes and, by Jove, it wouldn't have been safe. There are depths of horror in that thought. He looked as genuine as a new sovereign, but there was some infernal alloy in his metal. How much? The least thing, the least drop of something rare and accursed, the least drop. But he made you standing there with his don't care hang air. He made you wonder whether perchance he were nothing more rare than brass. I couldn't believe it. I tell you, I wanted to see him squirm for the honor of the craft. The other two no-account chaps spotted their captain, and began to move slowly towards us. They chatted together as they strolled, and I did not care any more than if they had not been visible to the naked eye. They grinned at each other, might have been exchanging jokes, for all I know. I saw that with one of them it was a case of a broken arm, and as to the long individual with grey mustaches, he was the chief engineer, and in various ways a pretty notorious personality. They were nobodies. They approached. The skipper gazed in an inanimate way between his feet. He seemed to be swollen to an unnatural size by some awful disease, by the mysterious action of an unknown poison. He lifted his head, saw the two before him waiting, opened his mouth with an extraordinary, sneering contortion of his puffed face to speak to them, I suppose, and then a thought seemed to strike him. His thick, purplish lips came together without a sound. He went off in a resolute waddle to the gharry and began to jerk at the door handle with such a blind brutality of impatience that I expected to see the whole concern overturned on its side, pony and all. The driver, shaken out of his meditation over the sole of his foot, displayed at once all the signs of intense terror, and held with both hands, looking round from his box at this vast carcass forcing its way into his conveyance. The little machine shook and rocked tumultuously, and the crimson nape of that lowered neck, the size of those straining thighs, the immense heaving of that dingy, striped green and orange back, the whole burrowing effort of that gaudy and sordid mass, troubled one's sense of probability with a droll and fearsome effect, like one of those grotesque and distinct visions that scare and fascinate one in a fever. He disappeared. I half expected the roof to split in two, the little box on wheels to burst open in the manner of a ripe cotton pod, but it only sank with a click of flattened springs, and suddenly one Venetian blind rattled down. His shoulders reappeared, jammed in the small opening, his head hung out, distended and tossing like a captive balloon, perspiring, furious, sputtering. He reached for the gharry wallah with vicious flourishes of a fist as dumpy and red as a lump of raw meat. He roared at him to be off, to go on. Where? Into the Pacific, perhaps. The driver lashed, the pony snorted, reared once, and darted off at a gallop. Where? To Apia? To Honolulu? He had 6,000 miles of tropical belt to disport himself in, and I did not hear the precise address. A snorting pony snatched him into Avicut in the twinkling of an eye, and I never saw him again. And, what's more, I don't know of anybody that ever had a glimpse of him after he departed from my knowledge, sitting inside a ramshackle little gharry that fled round the corner in a white smother of dust. He departed, disappeared, vanished, absconded, and absurdly enough it looked as though he had taken the gharry with him, for never again did I come across a sorrel pony with a slittier and a lackadaisical Tamil driver afflicted by a sore foot. The Pacific is indeed big, but whether he found a place for a display of his talents in it or not, the fact remains he had flown into space like a witch on a broomstick. The little chap with his arm in a sling started to run after the carriage, bleating, "Captain. I say, Captain. I say I." But after a few steps stopped short, hung his head, and walked back slowly. At the sharp rattle of the wheels the young fellow spun round where he stood. He made no other movement, no gesture, no sign, and remained facing in the new direction after the gharry had swung out of sight. All this happened in much less time than it takes to tell, since I am trying to interpret for you into slow speech the instantaneous effect of visual impressions. Next moment the half-caste clerk, sent by Archie to look a little after the poor castaways of the Patna, came upon the scene. He ran out eager and bareheaded, looking right and left, and very full of his mission. It was doomed to be a failure as far as the principal person was concerned, but he approached the others with fussy importance, and, almost immediately, found himself involved in a violent altercation with the chap that carried his arm in a sling, and who turned out to be extremely anxious for a row. He wasn't going to be ordered about, not he, but gosh! He wouldn't be terrified with a pack of lies by a cocky half-bred little quill driver. He was not going to be bullied by no object of that sort, if the story were true ever so. He bawled his wish, his desire, his determination to go to bed. If you weren't a godforsaken Portuguese, I heard him yell, you would know that the hospital is the right place for me. He pushed the fist of his sound arm under the other's nose, a crowd began to collect, the half-caste, flustered, but doing his best to appear dignified, tried to explain his intentions. I went away without waiting to see the end. But it so happened that I had a man in the hospital at the time, and going there to see about him the day before the opening of the inquiry, I saw in the white men's ward that little chap tossing on his back, with his arm in splints, and quite light-headed. To my great surprise the other one, the The long individual with drooping white mustache had also found his way there. I remembered I had seen him slinking away during the quarrel, in a half prance, half shuffle, and trying very hard not to look scared. He was no stranger to the port, it seems, and in his distress was able to make tracks straight for Mariani's billiard room and grog shop near the bazaar. That unspeakable vagabond, Mariani, who had known the man and had ministered to his vices in one or two other places, kissed the ground, in a manner of speaking, before him, and shut him up with a supply of bottles in an upstairs room of his infamous hovel. It appears he was under some hazy apprehension as to his personal safety, and wished to be concealed. However, Mariani told me a long time after, when he came on board one day to dun my steward for the price of some cigars, that he would have done more for him without asking any questions, from gratitude for some unholy favor received very many years ago as far as I could make out. He thumped twice his brawny chest, rolled enormous black and white eyes glistening with tears, "Antonio never forget, Antonio never forget." What was the precise nature of the immoral obligation I never learned, but be it what it may, he had every facility given him to remain under lock and key, with a chair, a table, a mattress in a corner, and a litter of fallen plaster on the floor, in an irrational state of funk, and keeping up his pecker with such tonics as Mariani dispensed. This lasted till the evening of the third day, when, after letting out a few horrible screams, he found himself compelled to seek safety and flight from a legion of centipedes. He burst the door open, made one leap for dear life down the crazy little stairway, landed bodily on Mariani's stomach, picked himself up, and bolted like a rabbit into the streets. The police plucked him off a garbage heap in the early morning. At first he had a notion they were carrying him off to be hanged, and fought for liberty like a hero, but when I sat down by his bed he had been very quiet for 2 days. His lean bronzed head, with white mustaches, looked fine and calm on the pillow, like the head of a war-worn soldier with a childlike soul, had it not been for a hint of spectral alarm that lurked in the blank glitter of his glance, resembling a nondescript form of a terror crouching silently behind a pane of glass. He was so extremely calm, that I began to indulge in the eccentric hope of hearing something explanatory of the famous affair from his point of view. Why, I longed to go grubbing into the deplorable details of an occurrence which, after all, concerned me no more than as a member of an obscure body of men held together by a community of inglorious toil and by fidelity to a certain standard of conduct, I can't explain. You may call it an unhealthy curiosity if you like, but I have a distinct notion I wished to find something. Perhaps, unconsciously, I hoped I would find that something, some profound and redeeming cause, some merciful explanation, some convincing shadow of an excuse. I see well enough now that I hoped for the impossible, for the laying of what is the most obstinate ghost of man's creation, of the uneasy doubt uprising like a mist, secret and gnawing like a worm, and more chilling than the certitude of death, the doubt of the sovereign power enthroned in a fixed standard of conduct. It is the hardest thing to stumble against, it is the thing that breeds yelling panics and good little quiet villainies, it's the true shadow of calamity. Did I believe in a miracle? And why did I desire it so ardently? Was it for my own sake that I wished to find some shadow of an excuse for that young fellow whom I had never seen before, but whose appearance alone added a touch of personal concern to the thoughts suggested by the knowledge of his weakness, made it a thing of mystery and terror, like a hint of a destructive fate ready for us all whose youth in its day had resembled his youth? I feared that such was the secret motive of my prying. I was, and no mistake, looking for a miracle. The only thing that at this distance of time strikes me as miraculous is the extent of my imbecility. I positively hoped to obtain from that battered and shady invalid some exorcism against the ghost of doubt. I must have been pretty desperate too, for, without loss of time, after a few indifferent and friendly sentences which he answered with languid readiness, just as any decent sick man would do, I produced the word potna wrapped up in a delicate question as in a wisp of floss silk. I was delicate selfishly, I did not want to startle him, I had no solicitude for him, I was not furious with him and sorry for him. His experience was of no importance, his redemption would have had no point for me. He had grown old in minor iniquities, and could no longer inspire aversion or pity. He repeated "Patna?" interrogatively, seemed to make a short effort of memory, and said, "Quite right. I am an old stager out here. I saw her go down." I made ready to vent my indignation at such a stupid lie, when he added smoothly, "She was full of reptiles." This made me pause. What did he mean? The unsteady phantom of terror behind his glassy eyes seemed to stand still and look into mine wistfully. "They turned me out of my bunk in the middle watch to look at her sinking," he pursued in a reflective tone. His voice sounded alarmingly strong all at once. I was sorry for my folly. There was no snowy winged coif of a nursing sister to be seen flitting in the perspective of the ward, but away in the middle of a long row of empty iron bedsteads, an accident case from some ship in the road sat up, brown and gaunt, with a white band of set rakishly on the forehead. Suddenly my interesting invalid shot out an arm thin like a tentacle and clawed my shoulder. Only my eyes were good enough to see. I am famous for my eyesight. That's why they called me, I expect. None of them was quick enough to see her go, but they saw that she was gone right enough, and sang out together like this. A wolfish howl searched the very recesses of my soul. Oh! Make him dry up, whined the accident case irritably. You don't believe me, I suppose, one on the other, with an air of ineffable conceit. I tell you there are no such eyes as mine this side of the Persian Gulf. Look under the bed. Of course I stooped instantly. I defy anybody not to have done so. What can you see? He asked. Nothing, I said, feeling awfully ashamed of myself. He scrutinized my face with wild and withering contempt. Just so, he said, but if I were to look I could see there's no eyes like mine, I tell you. Again he clawed, pulling at me downwards in his eagerness to relieve himself by a confidential communication. Millions of pink toads. There's no eyes like mine. Millions of pink toads. It's worse than seeing a ship sink. I could look at sinking ships and smoke my pipe all day long. Why don't they give me back my pipe? I would get a smoke while I watched these toads. The ship was full of them. They've got to be watched, you know. He winked facetiously. The perspiration dripped on him off my head, my drill coat clung to my wet back, the afternoon breeze swept impetuously over the row of bedsteads, the stiff folds of curtains stirred perpendicularly, rattling on brass rods, the covers of empty beds blew about noiselessly near the bare floor all along the line, and I shivered to the very marrow. The soft wind of the tropics played in the naked ward as bleak as a winter's gale in an old barn at home. Don't you let him start his hollering, mister, hailed from afar the accident case in a distressed angry shout that came ringing between the walls like a quavering call down a tunnel. The clawing hand hauled at my shoulder, he leered at me knowingly. The ship was full of them, you know, and we had to clear out on the strict QT, he whispered with extreme rapidity. All pink. All pinkos big as mastiffs, with an eye on the top of the head and claws all round their ugly mouths. Ook. Ook. Quick jerks as of galvanic shocks disclosed under the flat coverlet the outlines of meager and agitated legs, he let go my shoulder and reached after something in the air, his body trembled tensely like a released harp string, and while I looked down, the spectral horror in him broke through his glassy gaze. Instantly his face of an old soldier, with its noble and calm outlines, became decomposed before my eyes by the corruption of stealthy cunning, of an abominable caution and of desperate fear. He restrained a cry SSH. What are they doing now down there? He asked, pointing to the floor with fantastic precautions of voice and gesture, whose meaning, borne upon my mind in a lurid flash, made me very sick of my cleverness. They are all asleep, I answered, watching him narrowly. That was it. That's what he wanted to hear, these were the exact words that could calm him. He drew a long breath. SSH. Quiet, steady. I am an old stager out here. I know them brutes. Bash in the head of the first that stirs. There's too many of them, and she won't swim more than 10 minutes. He panted again. Hurry up, he yelled suddenly, and went on in a steady scream, they are all awake, millions of them. They are trampling on me. Wait. Oh, wait. I'll smash them in heaps like flies. Wait for me. Help. Help. An interminable and sustained howl completed my discomfiture. I saw in the distance the accident case raise deplorably both his hands to his bandaged head, a dresser, apron to the chin showed himself in the vista of the ward, as if seen in the small end of a telescope. I confessed myself fairly routed, and without more ado, stepping out through one of the long windows, escaped into the outside gallery. The howl pursued me like a vengeance. I turned into a deserted landing, and suddenly all became very still and quiet around me, and I descended the bare and shiny staircase in a silence that enabled me to compose my distracted thoughts. Down below I met one of the resident surgeons who was crossing the courtyard and stopped me. Been to see your man, Captain? I think we may let him go tomorrow. These fools have no notion of taking care of themselves, though. I say, we've got the chief engineer of that pilgrim ship here. A curious case. DTs of the worst kind. He has been drinking hard in the Greek's or Italian's grog shop for 3 days. What can you expect? 4 bottles of that kind of brandy a day, I am told. Wonderful. If true. Sheeted with boiler iron inside I should think. The head, ah. The head, of course, gone, but the curious part is there's some sort of method in his raving. I am trying to find out. Most unusual, that thread of logic in such a delirium. Traditionally he ought to see snakes, But he doesn't. Good old traditions at a discount nowadays. A. His Eurovisions are Batrachian. Ha. Ha. No, seriously, I never remember being so interested in a case of Jim Jams before. He ought to be dead, don't you know, after such a festive experiment. Oh. He is a tough object. 4 and 20 years of the tropics too. You ought really to take a peep at him. Noble looking old boozer. Most extraordinary man I ever met medically, of course. Won't you? I have been all along exhibiting the usual polite signs of interest, but now assuming an air of regret I murmured of one of time, and shook hands in a hurry. I say, he cried after me, he can't attend that inquiry. Is his evidence material, you think? Not in the least, I called back from the gateway. Chapter 6. The authorities were evidently of the same opinion. The inquiry was not adjourned. It was held on the appointed day to satisfy the law, and it was well attended because of its human interest, no doubt. There was no incertitude as to facts as to the one material fact, I mean. How the Patna came by or heard it was impossible to find out, the court did not expect to find out, and in the whole audience there was not a man who cared. Yet, as I've told you, all the sailors in the port attended, and the waterside business was fully represented. Whether they knew it or not, the interest that drew them here was purely psychological, the expectation of some essential disclosure as to the strength, the power, the horror, of human emotions. Naturally, nothing of the kind could be disclosed. The examination of the only man able and willing to face it was beating futilely round the well-known fact, and the play of questions upon it was as instructive as the tapping with a hammer on an iron box, with the object to find out what's inside. However, an official inquiry could not be any other thing. Its object was not the fundamental why, but the superficial how, of this affair. The young chap could have told them, and, though that very thing was the thing that interested the audience, the questions put to him necessarily led him away from what to me, for instance, would have been the only truth worth knowing. You can't expect the constituted authorities to inquire into the state of a man's soul, or is it only of his liver? Their business was to come down upon the consequences, and frankly, a casual police magistrate and 2 nautical assessors are not much good for anything else. I don't mean to imply these fellows were stupid. The magistrate was very patient. One of the assessors was a sailing ship skipper with a reddish beard, and of a pious disposition. Brierly was the other. Big Brierly. Some of you must have heard of Big Brierly, the captain of the crack ship of the Blue Star Line. That's the man. He seemed consumedly bored by the honor thrust upon him. He had never in his life made a mistake, never had an accident, never a mishap, never a check in his steady rise, and he seemed to be one of those lucky fellows who know nothing of indecision, much less of self-mistrust. At 32 he had one of the best commands going in the Eastern trade and, what's more, he thought a lot of what he had. There was nothing like it in the world, and I suppose if you had asked him point blank he would have confessed that in his opinion there was not such another commander. The choice had fallen upon the right man. The rest of mankind that did not command the 16-knot steel steamer Asa were rather poor creatures. He had saved lives at sea, had rescued ships in distress, had a gold chronometer presented to him by the underwriters, and a pair of binoculars with a suitable inscription from some foreign government, in commemoration of these services. He was acutely aware of his merits and of his rewards. I liked him well enough, though some I know meek, friendly men at that couldn't stand him at any price. I haven't the slightest doubt he considered himself vastly my superior indeed. Had you been emperor of East and West, you could not have ignored your inferiority in his presence, but I couldn't get up any real sentiment of offense. He did not despise me for anything I could help, for anything I was, don't you know? I was a negligible quantity simply because I was not the fortunate man of the earth, not Montague Brierly in command of the Asa, not the owner of an inscribed gold chronometer and of silver-mounted binoculars testifying to the excellence of my seamanship and to my indomitable pluck, not possessed of an acute sense of my merits and of my rewards, besides the love and worship of a black retriever, the most wonderful of its kind, for never was such a man loved thus by such a dog. No doubt, to have all this forced upon you was exasperating enough, but when I reflected that I was associated in these fatal disadvantages with 1,200 millions of other more or less human beings, I found I could bear my share of his good-natured and contemptuous pity for the sake of something indefinite and attractive in the man. I have never defined to myself this attraction, but there were moments when I envied him. The sting of life could do no more to his complacent soul than the scratch of a pin to the smooth face of a rock. This was enviable. As I looked at him, flanking on one side the unassuming pale-faced magistrate who presided at the inquiry, his self-satisfaction presented to me and to the world a surface as hard as granite. He committed suicide very soon after. No wonder Jim's case bored him, and while I thought with something akin to fear of the immensity of his contempt for the young man under examination, he was probably holding silent inquiry into his own case. The verdict must have been of unmitigated guilt, and he took the secret of the evidence with him in that leap into the sea. If I understand anything of men, the matter was no doubt of the gravest import, one of those trifles that awaken ideas, start into life some thought with which a man unused to such a companionship finds it impossible to live. I am in a position to know that it wasn't money, and it wasn't drink, and it wasn't woman. He jumped overboard at sea barely a week after the end of the inquiry, and less than 3 days after leaving port on his outward passage, as though on that exact spot in the midst of waters he had suddenly perceived the gates of the other world flung open wide for his reception. Yet it was not a sudden impulse. His gray-headed mate, a first-rate sailor and a nice old chap with strangers, but in his relations with his commander the surliest chief officer I've ever seen, would tell the story with tears in his eyes. It appears that when he came on deck in the morning Brierly had been writing in the chart room. It was 4:10, he said, and the middle watch was not relieved yet, of course. He heard my voice on the bridge speaking to the second mate, and called me in. I was loath to go, and that's the truth, Captain Marlowe. I couldn't stand poor Captain Brierly, I tell you with shame, we never know what a man is made of. He had been promoted over too many heads, not counting my own, and he had a damnable trick of making you feel small, nothing but by the way he said good morning. I never addressed him, sir, but on matters of duty, and that it was as much as I could do to keep a civil tongue in my head. He flattered himself there. I often wondered how Brierly could put up with his manners for more than half a voyage. I've a wife and children, he went on, and I had been 10 years in the company, always expecting the next command more fool I. Says he, just like this, come in here, Mr. Jones, in that swagger voice of his, come in here, Mr. Jones. In I went. We'll lay down her position, says he, stooping over the chart, a pair of dividers in hand. By the standing orders, the officer going off duty would have done that at the end of his watch. However, I said nothing, and looked on while he marked off the ship's position with a tiny cross and wrote the date and the time. I can see him this moment writing his neat figures, 17, 8, 4 a.m. The year would be written in red ink at the top of the chart. He never used his charts more than a year, Captain Brierly didn't. I've the chart now. When he had done he stands looking down at the mark he had made and smiling to himself, then looks up at me. 32 miles more as she goes, says he, and then we shall be clear, and you may alter the course 20 degrees to the southward. We were passing to the north of the Hector Bank that voyage. I said, all right, sir, wondering what he was fussing about, since I had to call him before altering the course anyhow. Just then 8 bells were struck, we came out on the bridge, and the second mate before going off mentions in the usual way 71 on the log. Captain Brierly looks at the compass and then all round. It was dark and clear, and all the stars were out as plain as on a frosty night in high latitudes. Suddenly he says with a sort of a little sigh, I am going aft, and shall set a log at zero for you myself, so that there can be no mistake. 32 miles more on this course and then you are safe. Let's see, the correction on the log is 6%. Additive, say, then, 30 by the dial to run, and you may come 20 degrees to starboard at once. No use losing any distance, is there? I had never heard him talk so much at a stretch, and to no purpose as it seemed to me. I said nothing. He went down the ladder, and the dog, that was always at his heels whenever he moved, night or day, followed, sliding nose first, after him. I heard his boot heels tap, tap on the after deck, then he stopped and spoke to the dog aback, Rover. On the bridge, boy. Go on, get. Then he calls out to me from the dark, shut the dog up in the chart room, Mr. Jones, will you? This was the last time I heard his voice, Captain Marlowe. These are the last words he spoke in the hearing of any living human being, sir. At this point the old chap's voice got quite unsteady. He was afraid the poor brute would jump after him, don't you see? He pursued with a quaver. Yes, Captain Marlowe. He set the log for me, he would you believe it? He put a drop of oil in it too. There was the oil feeder where he left it nearby. The bosun's mate got the hose along aft to wash down at 5:30. By and by he knocks off and runs up on the bridge, will you please come aft, Mr. Jones, he says. There's a funny thing. I don't like to touch it. It was Captain Brierly's gold chronometer watch carefully hung under the rail by its chain. As soon as my eyes fell on it something struck me, and I knew, sir. My legs got soft under me. It was as if I had seen him go over, and I could tell how far behind he was left too. The taffrail log marked 18 miles and 3/4, and 4 iron belaying pins were missing round the mainmast. Put them in his pockets to help him down, I suppose, but, Lord. What's 4 iron pins to a powerful man like Captain Brierly? Maybe his confidence in himself was just shook a bit at the last. That's the only sign of fluster he gave in his whole life, I should think, but I am ready to answer for him, that once over he did not try to swim a stroke, the same as he would have had pluck enough to keep up all day long on the bare chance had he fallen overboard accidentally. Yes, sir. He was second to none if he said so himself, as I heard him once. He had written 2 letters in the middle watch, one to the company and the other to me. He gave me a lot of instructions as to the passage I had been in the trade before he was out of his time and no end of hints as to my conduct with our people in Shanghai, so that I should keep the command of the Asa. He wrote like a father would to a favorite son, Captain Marlowe, and I was 25 years his senior and had tasted salt water before he was fairly breeched. In his letter to the owners it was left open for me to see. He said that he had always done his duty by them up to that moment and even now he was not betraying their confidence, since he was leaving the ship to as competent a seaman as could be found, meaning me, sir, meaning me. He told them that if the last act of his life didn't take away all his credit with them, they would give way to my faithful service and to his warm recommendation, when about to fill the vacancy made by his death. And much more like this, sir. I couldn't believe my eyes. It made me feel queer all over. Went on the old chap, in great perturbation, and squashing something in the corner of his eye with the end of a thumb as broad as a spatula. You would think, sir, he had jumped overboard only to give an unlucky man a last show to get on. What with the shock of him going in this awful rash way, and thinking myself a made man by that chance, I was nearly off my chump for a week. But no fear. The captain of the Pelion was shifted into the Asa, came aboard in Shanghai a little popinjay, sir, in a grey check suit, with his hair parted in the middle. I am your new captain, Mr. O. Jones. He was drowned in scent, fairly stunk with it, Captain Marlowe. I dare say it was the look I gave him that made him stammer. He mumbled something about my natural disappointment. I had better know at once that his chief officer got the promotion to the Pelion. He had nothing to do with it. Of course, suppose the office knew best, sorry. Says I, don't you mind old Jones, sir, damn his soul, he's used to it. I could see directly I had shocked his delicate ear, and while we sat at our first tiffin together he began to find fault in a nasty manner with this and that in the ship. I never heard such a voice out of a Punch and Judy show. I set my teeth hard, and glued my eyes to my plate, and held my peace as long as I could, but at last I had to say something. Up he jumps tiptoeing, ruffling all his pretty plumes, like a little fighting cock. You'll find you have a different person to deal with than the late Captain Brierly. I've found it, says I, very glum, but pretending to be mighty busy with my steak. You are an old ruffian, Mr. O. Jones, and what's more, you are known for an old ruffian in the employ, he squeaks at me. The damned bottle washers stood about listening with their mouths stretched from ear to ear. I may be a hard case, answers I, but I ain't so far gone as to put up with the sight of you sitting in Captain Brierly's chair. With that I lay down my knife and fork. You would like to sit in it yourself, that's where the shoe pinches, he sneers. I left the saloon, got my rags together, and was on the quay with all my dunnage about my feet before the stevedores had turned to again. Yes. Adrift on shore after 10 years service and with a poor woman and 4 children 6,000 miles off depending on my half pay for every mouthful they ate. Yes, sir. I chucked it rather than hear Captain Brierly abused. He left me his night glasses, here they are, and he wished me to take care of the dog, here he is. Hello, Rover, poor boy. Where's the captain, Rover? The dog looked up at us with mournful yellow eyes, gave one desolate bark, and crept under the table. All this was taking place, more than 2 years afterwards, on board that nautical ruin the Fire Queen. This Jones had got charge of quite by a funny accident, 2 from Matherson, Mad Matherson they generally called him, the same who used to hang out in Haiphong, you know, before the occupation days. The old chap snuffled on. Eh, sir, Captain Brierly will be remembered here, if there's no other place on earth. I wrote fully to his father and did not get a word in reply, neither thank you, nor go to the devil. Nothing. Perhaps they did not want to know. The sight of that watery-eyed old Jones mopping his bald head with a red cotton handkerchief, the sorrowing yelp of the dog, the squalor of that fly-blown cutty which was the only shrine of his memory, threw a veil of inexpressibly mean pathos over Brierly's remembered figure, the posthumous revenge of fate for that belief in his own splendor which had almost cheated his life of its legitimate terrors. Almost. Perhaps wholly. Who can tell what flattering view he had induced himself to take of his own suicide? Why did he commit the rash act, Captain Marlowe, can you think? Asked Jones, pressing his palms together. Why? It beats me. Why? He slapped his low and wrinkled forehead. If he had been poor and old and in debt and never a show or else mad. But he wasn't of the kind that goes mad, not he. You trust me. What a mate don't know about his skipper isn't worth knowing. Young, healthy, well off, no cares. I sit here sometimes thinking, thinking, till my head fairly begins to buzz. There was some reason. You may depend on it, Captain Jones, said I, it wasn't anything that would have disturbed much either of us two, I said, and then, as if a light had been flashed into the muddle of his brain, poor old Jones found a last word of amazing profundity. He blew his nose, nodding at me dolefully, Neither you nor I, sir, had ever thought so much of ourselves. Of course the recollection of my last conversation with Brierly is tinged with the knowledge of his end that followed so close upon it. I spoke with him for the last time during the progress of the inquiry. It was after the first adjournment, and he came up with me in the street. He was in a state of irritation, which I noticed with surprise, his usual behavior when he condescended to converse being perfectly cool, with a trace of amused tolerance, as if the existence